Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast with over 6 million unique listeners in 177 countries. This is Jason Henricks with my friend and partner, JP Nichols. How are you feeling today, JP?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, it's Brett's worst nightmare. He's on a plane somewhere and he threw the keys to us for the whole show this week. So I'm looking forward to that. But I'm feeling pretty good. I'm a little sore. I think, you know, I started playing soccer again for the first time in nearly 30 years last fall. And now spring season starting, we had our first practice and scrimmage yesterday. So I'm limping a little bit. So I'm glad to sit down and talk to you.
Well, I'm glad to know how you're feeling, but I really wonder, how are you feeling about money?
Well, I'd say in general, I'm in favor of it. I suppose too much of it can cause some problems, but most people I know want to have more of it.
Well, and how do you feel about your money?
I would like to have more of it.
You would have to like to have more of it. So, you know what? Turns out you are like most Americans who spend a huge amount of their time focused on money, lack of it, fear of running out of it, and where it's all going. So today on the show, we're going to talk about financial wellness. Jennifer Tesher, founder and CEO of the Center for Financial Service Innovation, joins us in the first half to talk about what she's observed over the last decade and a half in CFSI's U.S. Financial Health Pulse and the role of financial institutions in solving this wellness crisis. A recent poll of 1,000 Americans found 85% are stressed about money, at least some of the times, and a full 30% are constantly stressed about money. So when you say you could use more of it, I think you're at least firmly in the 85%.
Oh, I'm definitely in the 85%. You know how it is being an entrepreneur. You have good months and you have bad months. And when you have the bad months, you're trying to count desperately to get to that good month again to even it all out.
Well, and the entrepreneur, and you know, we've talked about this quite a bit when we've had Theo Lau on and Brad Limer and the work that we've done together with aging, you know, working with my parents now and realizing, you know, the uncertainty around how much money do they need, not just in retirement, but with potential healthcare costs and what that's going to look like, you know, it's just frightening. And when you look at some of the data that Bankrate did in a study, they found that over half of Americans couldn't cover a $1,000 emergency. And it isn't just, you know, a U.S. issue. The German National Well-Being Survey reported less than a third of Germans felt they were able to live financially free. Now, think about this. This is a country with one of the highest savings rates and one of the best balances between what people spend versus what they earn. Mm-hmm. And only a third of them are feeling that certainty. And then Willis Towers and Watson did a study of their Asian Pacific employees and found that 43% often worried about their financial future. In a period of rising prosperity, greater access to information and technological tools, the question is, why are we so financially unwell?
No, that's right. And I'm really glad we're talking about this today. I saw, too, a survey by Mercer said 25% of employees admit that financial worries impact their productivity, which of course means that it's impacting the businesses as well. I'm going to talk to Jennifer about that. 45% said that financial worries is their number one cause of stress, and stress is the number one cause of absenteeism, easier for me to say, which results into about 15 million workdays off each year in the UK alone. So you're right, it's a global phenomenon. And then in the second segment, we're going to continue this talk with Dean Brower. He is the co-founder of the GoHenry app, and he's going to talk to us about how they're trying to teach kids financial smarts from the very start.
Yeah. Well, and fittingly, today's show is brought to you by Village Capital, one of the most active fintech accelerators in the world. And Village Capital is recruiting startups for its FinTech and Financial Health Accelerator program that will be taking place in October through December. You can gain access to their networks of investors, mentors, potential customers, and other founders. And one of the best parts, Village Capital does not charge, and it does not take equity to participate in the accelerator program. Village Cap is going to host a series of community events around the country to recruit startups, starting in Atlanta, April 22nd, Miami on May 29th, Los Angeles on June 6th, and Seattle on June 18th, and they're going to wrap it up Columbus on June 26th. The team will also attend several conferences, including South by Southwest, where they're going to be hanging out with me at the Luminaires, Empire FinTech, FinTech South, Finnovate Spring 2019, and many others. If you're working on fintech or financial health and would like to learn more about Village Capital and its accelerator program, go to vilcap.com. Applications don't open until Thursday, June 6th, but it is not too early to start learning and planning, and they've got a great team happy to educate you about what it would be like to go through their program.
Well, you mentioned South by Southwest already, and we do have some conference announcements, and I can't believe how that's just right around the corner. Jason, of course, you will be hosting the annual FinTech Luminaires reception, as you have been for the last few years. So you can join entrepreneurs, executives, investors, and influencers on March 9th for cocktails and conversation just before the madness kicks off at South by.
Oh, yes. It is my favorite part of that time, because at a mere 300 people that are carefully screened to be at this reception, you know you're getting quality in the people you're talking to. And I want to give a special thanks to our partners at Sunrise Bank, Rocket Dollar, and Yodlee for making this event happen year after year. Their support makes it a phenomenal event. If you're interested in attending and you are not on our list, tweet at me, at Jason Henricks or at Breaking Banks One, and would love to get you an invite.
Yeah, I know. The tickets are few and far between, so get in early if you want to attend. On April 9th and 10th, it's the S&P Global 8th Annual Community Bankers Conference in Dallas. Jason, you'll be there with Chris Nichols. Chris is the Chief Strategy Officer of Center State Bank and also one of the co-founders of the Alloy Labs Alliance. And the two of you are going to talk about what banks need to do to prepare for 2025. I'm sure you're looking forward to that as much as all of the attendees.
Yeah, 2025 seems like it's right around the corner, which is really weird to think about.
Yeah, it's coming quickly, as is the Seamless Middle East Conference coming up on April 10th and 11th. And Provoke is a podcast partner for Seamless Middle East. It's a dynamic summit and large-scale exhibition bringing together the converging worlds of e-commerce, retail, payments, fintech, and identity. And you can register at seamless-expo.com/ME for Middle East. And finally, our friends at the Financial Brand Forum, Jeffrey Pilcher, our good friend and regular contributor, Jim Marus, of course, will be there as he always is. That is coming up in Las Vegas on the 15th through the 17th of April. You can experience the world's largest and most elite conference on marketing, CX, data analytics, and digital transformation in the banking industry. Over 2,000 plus senior leaders from more than 750 financial institutions will attend the Financial Brand Forum in 2019, and you can get your tickets at financialbrandforum.com. If you have something you'd like to share with our audience, you can hit us on Twitter at Breaking Banks One or just email us at info@provoke.fm. So, Jason, I know we're going to talk about financial health, and this sort of fits in maybe, but when I think about the news this week, what's happened since last show, the news of Apple and Goldman Sachs teaming up to launch a new consumer credit card, I think is pretty interesting. Our other good friend and regular contributor, Ron Shevlin, had a piece in Forbes this week. He says three reasons why they will strike out. He says, first, rewards are not good enough. Secondly, the money management features aren't good enough. And third, Apple isn't strong enough on data and analytics capabilities. So what do you think about all that?
Well, so, you know, rewards are my jam. When we think about changing people's financial behavior, right, it's a combination of stick, carrot, and removing friction. And I have no doubt that Apple is going to just nail the user experience, but I don't think they fully appreciate when you get a bunch of engineers thinking about the rewards program, how are they going to actually do that? Because people are really funny about the way they think about rewards, right? Mm-hmm. Often this was a surprise to me when I started spending more time in the reward space, is it isn't actually redeeming. Actually saving your rewards gives you a big dopamine spike. You feel mm-hmm. good about it. The more aspirational, the better it can be. And I'm not sure that their kind of lower value, much more tangible pieces of rewards are going to be enough. And I don't know, you're a rewards guy too. We talk about that. When traveling for Forge, we're Starwood folks. That's where we go and have our loyalties. Trish tries to get us over to the Hilton. How do you think about the rewards and what they're offering? Would you switch?
Oh, it's interesting that you say that. In some work I've done on this in the past, I know one of the things we thought about is, the utility of certain rewards that people really want that are very highly functional. And then there are those also aspirational rewards that they never use, but they actually are interesting for people to sign up. And you just brought another thing to it that I hadn't thought about before, but I think it's true. I love accumulating my frequent flyer miles, and I always feel a pain when I actually spend them. I mean, logically, that makes no sense. The reason you accumulate them is so that you can use them. There's no benefit of seeing a big number in my account. There's a benefit for me getting a free upgrade or a free flight or taking my family somewhere. But I don't like to actually cash them in. Are you a hoarder of your frequent flyer miles?
No. So I've gone the opposite extreme. If I see, more than a couple thousand points, I realize that, it's a wasting asset. If you're not the one gaming, you're the one being gamed. So, we focus very much on, even when it's for business travel, I don't mind throwing in my points to buy down the price, rather than just seeing a huge, number sitting out there. Now, right. I do get why people like that, because of the, aspirational aspect. You look at it and you're like dreaming about that vacation. So you see, oh man, I have enough for, two tickets to go, to Hawaii in the middle of February from Chicago. And then I'm like, if I only save a little bit more, like another year's worth, I can fly first class on the way there. And, it lures you into dreaming versus actually spending it like a real asset.
Right. Well, and, we'll have Ron on the show to speak his own words here that he wrote up. But in the article he wrote for Forbes, he says that generally speaking, successful credit cards address one of three consumer segments: those looking for rewards, those looking for a low interest rate, or those choosing a card based on affinity. And his point is that, they already have their Apple's Barclay card. And as far as he knows, and as far as I know, that hasn't really been very successful. But I would say that I think there is an affinity play here. And I would maybe attach that also to just the habitual play. The fact that, people are very used to the Apple ecosystem, and if they can make it one step more seamless inside the wallet, that might lead to more adoption.
It raises the question: how many people are actually using the wallet on a regular basis for most of their spend? Because if it being embedded in the wallet and the better cash management features, that means it's got most of my spend. And I just think that there are so many other ways people could be doing this, but they're not. It's the proverbial espoused versus enacted behavior. And something I think we're probably going to get into with Jennifer and GoHenry, which is, we know how to lose weight. We need to eat less and move more, yet obesity is on the rise. We know how to alleviate financial stress. Now, not true across the board because there's access issues for many people, but it's about managing your spend under what you're actually bringing in, yet many of us don't do that. And I'm not sure having this embedded in the wallet's going to solve that problem.
Well, you may be right. I'll mark me down as cautiously optimistic, though, just as Apple has made some inroads into physical health around, the integration that they have with Apple Watch and some of the analytics there. I'm hopeful that a device that people use, several dozen times per day might actually help their financial health, which is what we're going to talk about today.
Well, and maybe if we tap into that same thing, you know, we've talked about this before. We'll go pound out a couple thousand more steps just to, you know, keep our average up, or to keep, you know, you and your meditation, keep your streak going. You know, they've done a good job of changing your behavior with their ability to, you know, give you timely messages around, you know, when you have done it in the past, what you should be doing, how long you've been doing it. You know, maybe there's something there, and I'm just being a cynic. I'm channeling Ron.
Well, that's not necessarily recommended, because only Ron is Ron. But we'll find out who's right, and we'll hear from Ron himself on an upcoming episode, and we'll see where this goes.
Fantastic. So want to introduce our first guest, Jennifer Tesher, longtime friend and mentor. Jennifer, I don't know anyone who's thought as long and hard about financial wellness as you and the team at the Center for Financial Service Innovation. You've been at this for over, is it 16 years? Maybe, yeah, about that. And your focus has expanded from the unbanked to include the underbanked, something you and I argued about. I still remember the first time we met that I said most Americans are probably underbanked and we shouldn't just focus on the unbanked. And you absolutely agreed. And now you look broadly at financial wellness. Can you tell us about the CFSI founding story? How did you find your way into this business? What have you learned over these last 16 years?
It's so glad to be on. And you're dating me. Actually, it'll be 15 years this April that okay. I founded the organization, but we have been at it for a long time. And when we started, we were about answering the question of how can the changes in technology improve access to financial services for those who need it most. And this was 2004. So Google went public that year. Mark Zuckerberg invented the Facebook in his dorm room that year, but we were pre-iPhone, and we didn't even quite realize just how ahead of our time we were. There was no fintech yet, or at least no word fintech, but there were millions and millions of Americans who either didn't have a bank account or who had one, but it wasn't really meeting all their needs. So we spent the first roughly 10 years really focused on trying to spotlight on the needs of those consumers and making a business case to financial services companies, primarily banks back then, that this was a real market opportunity. It wasn't just like the right thing to do. This was a good thing to do from a business perspective.
It's not just marketing, you know, because I worry, and this is something that we felt from our board at Park Street, is they looked at this idea of helping our customers make better financial choices was a marketing expense. It was about acquiring customers. So is there really an underlying business case there?
Oh, absolutely. We demonstrated that people were spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on financial services and still not getting what they needed. So it wasn't a demand problem, it was a supply problem. So 10 years is a long time, and a lot happened in that 10 years. The iPhone was invented, making access ubiquitous. The financial crisis demonstrated that even if you had access, you still could be harmed. And the recession showed us that this was not a niche problem, that the majority of Americans were indeed struggling financially. And it was hidden from us in plain sight, if you will, in large part because people were significantly over-indebted, but we were still looking at averages over the course of a year, as opposed to really deeply understanding the financial needs of consumers. And that's when we really pivoted to financial health.
So let's pick up on that pivot a little bit. What has changed over the past 15 years? You mentioned the advent of the technologies we all live with daily today weren't technologies that were even around 15 years ago. And we talked about the change of how the traditional financial institutions have been dealing with this. How's the mission evolved during the last 15 years?
The mission is, in many ways, has stayed the same. I think the biggest shift is that we realized that access alone wasn't really the problem, and frankly, wasn't sufficient. And in part because of technology and the advent of things like prepaid debit cards, which 15 years ago were still called stored value cards, access has really largely been tackled, at least in the United States or other developed countries. So a very small percentage of people in America don't have a bank account. And of those, about half of them have had one at one point in time. They just happen to not have one when the survey person calls to ask them the question. So the challenges we have are not just about having access. Lots of people have access to bank accounts or to financial vehicles, but they don't have short-term savings. They don't have any retirement savings. They have too much debt. They have a poor credit score. They're not able to plan for the future.
So if the lack of access to the right kind of tools and products is not the problem, what do you think is the major problem in the U.S. or in developed nations?
I think that there are a number of structural challenges that have been decades in the making. Things like inequality, the fact that wages aren't keeping pace with productivity, and that much of the country really hasn't seen wage gains, certainly from an inflation-adjusted perspective, in 30 years. So now people are working multiple jobs, and they're barely getting by. So there are a whole host of policy challenges and structural challenges that this country faces. But the fact is, those are going to take a while to solve. And people are really challenged right now. And so we really are both trying to change the understanding and the conversation about what business we're in as financial services providers, and to leverage technology to think about how we can give people tools right now to improve their day-to-day systems so that they can build resilience and pursue opportunity.
Yeah, in that need is very pronounced. Last year, for any listeners who haven't seen it yet, CFSI put together a survey for financial wellness in the U.S., and last year was the baseline year, and the results were sobering. 72% of Americans were either financially coping, which you defined as struggling with some, but not necessarily all aspects of their financial lives, or were financially vulnerable, meaning they struggled with nearly every aspect of their financial lives. Were you surprised by the results and just how stark this was?
I wish I could say I were surprised, but after 15 years, nothing really surprises me anymore. I take that back. The only thing that surprises me is that there are so many people who continue to be surprised by these results, because I feel like we've been talking about them for so long. But we, many of us live in a bubble, and we don't realize that it's, you know, the person sitting at the reception desk when we walk in the office in the morning, or the person caring for our kids, or maybe it's a family member. But that this isn't necessarily the homeless person on the street. They've got very significant challenges. They've got a whole host of challenges. There are people who look like they have all the trappings of what would look like financial success. They have a job, they own a car, they have a house, they even have a 401k and maybe health insurance through their employer. But underneath all of that, they are one missed paycheck or one emergency away from a real crisis. And if we needed any real example of that, it would be the government shutdown.
As we were preparing for this, I was reading an interesting survey coming out of Germany. Does a financial wellness and a general well-being for the country survey. And in some of the comments, one of the things that I found really interesting was the concept in the U.S. around car ownership, that in most of Europe, if you look at income and the amount that goes to your vehicle, it's roughly 10%, and it scales actually very linearly with your income. So the fancy foreign cars are driven by executives and, you know, people who are at the entry level or still working to get by are more likely to have a used car, one with over 100,000 miles. And then the commentator pointed to the U.S., which they said it was just astounding to them that, you know, you find someone who's working on the factory floor is driving, you know, the same car or a fancy truck, as an executive who's making 10 times what they do. How much do you think this societal pressure is playing into some of the problems? Is it a problem of our own making?
That's a really interesting question. On the one hand, I absolutely agree that when you live in a country where 70% of GDP is predicated on consumer spending, that that can't help but contribute to our values as a country and the fact that we have a savings rate that is as low as it is. That is not because we're just all profligate spenders. It's because that's the culture of this country, as opposed to, say, a Japan, where maybe they're oversaving. But on the other hand, I do think it's important to note that when we think about a healthy day-to-day financial system, it's really made up of two parts. One are those decisions and choices you make every day, and they are really important. But the other is also all of the hard stuff, I call it. Institutions, products, laws, the things that facilitate your ability to participate effectively. And it's got to be both of those things. Like, how many people do you know who have perfect access, could have choice of any product and service they want? They're white, and so they, you know, really have no issues at all. But they make really poor decisions and choices. But on the other hand, how many people do we know who, God bless them, they're doing everything right, but they just don't have access to the same systems, rules of the game, connections, networks, and so aren't getting the tools and help that they need.
Well, we need to take a little break right now, but we will be back after the break with more from Jennifer Tesher from CFSI.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back to Breaking Banks, and we're still here with Jennifer Tesher from CFSI. So if you could pick one thing you'd like consumers to do differently to help improve their financial wellness, what would it be? And then as a follow-up, what about the financial institutions? What's the number one thing they could do differently in your mind?
Mm-hmm. If there's one thing consumers could do, it's save. And I'm not talking about saving large sums of money. Mm-hmm. You know, the most often quoted statistic is the Fed stat that 40% of Americans couldn't come up with $400 in an emergency, which
right.
Every time I hear it, I'm just blown away by it. Now, that number has improved somewhat over the last few years, but still 40%, staggering. And we're talking about $400. So if we could get everyone on the bandwagon to, over the course of time, put together a couple $100s, even $250, to have a little bit of a cushion in place, I think that would be so beneficial, particularly where we are right now in the credit cycle. I couldn't feel more strongly about this, given the timing, that it's not an if we're going to have a downturn, it's a when. And I doubt it will look anything like the last one we just had, of course not, but it was going to absolutely hurt Main Street America the most.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show last week, that, you know, we don't know exactly when or exactly how bad, but there's no doubt that this expansionary cycle ends at some point. And to your point, if we don't start getting some of these pieces in place now, it's only going to be harder when the economy turns south.
Well, and it is so frustrating, because the credit cycle being what it is, that it kind of happens the same way every time, and we seemingly never learn the lesson. Like, what are we doing to prepare for the soft landing, right? This is the time to, and you're seeing some companies do this, right? Pulling back a little bit on consumer credit, but frankly, not enough, right? Consumer debt levels are at, you know, all-time highs again. And it may not look like it did 10 years ago, but it's getting up there. So I just, everyone needs a couple $100 squirreled away somewhere.
Well, and sure, that's not a secret formula, right? It's a little bit like weight loss. We all know what we need to do to lose weight. You know, it's eat less, move more. So what are some of the things that as a consumer they could use as a tool to help? Have you found, you know, because awareness, it doesn't seem to be the problem.
Totally.
It's the actual making the change. Are there some tools out there you've seen, you know, CFSI runs its labs out of San Francisco that really does a great job of curating startups that are focused on this? Are there banks that you think are doing a particularly good job? How can we actually get the consumers the help they need?
Yeah. You know, could you imagine, like, if we were doing this show 5 years ago, could you imagine that we would have seen the explosion of innovation in short-term savings that we've seen? I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? Because no one thinks about this as being a real business opportunity. But I think that people are so hungry for tools to help them be their best selves, that there's a real market for these tools. So we were an early investor in Digit, which was this idea that I give the company access to my checking account and they use algorithms to see my cash flow and they kind of crawl around looking for this hidden change, if you will, in the cushions of my bank account and then sweep it over to savings, really without you having to think about it. And so we're seeing lots of flavors and versions like that. Then you have Acorns, you have folks who are doing things around Roundup. Fifth Third just announced Dobot. Not really sure about that name, but also an opportunity for small savings. So you're right, this isn't rocket science. It is behavioral economics and thinking about how to create the right incentives to, again, help us be our best selves. But there are just tremendous number of tools out there right now.
Well, tremendous tools, and they do a great job, you know, using Digit as an example where they can help take the friction out by automating some of this. And when you look forward, think about some of the new technologies coming on the horizon, you know, there's all the promise of, you know, AI and personalized, you know, bots and things like that. Do you think that's going to be part of what helps turn this around, or, you know, is that just false promise?
I think it remains to be seen. I'm an optimist. I do think that I care a lot less about intention than I do about outcome. So don't get me started on the topic of financial literacy and education, but, you know, it's not about what you know, it's about what you do. Yeah. And to the degree that machine learning can decomplexify, I just made up a new word, people's financial lives, the stuff that takes up way too much brain space and lets us focus on the things that are that really require our engagement, I think the better off we'll be. Now, I think the challenge is that there are patterns in people's financial lives, but they are, if not infinite, then they are extraordinarily varied. And those patterns are inconsistent. So maybe they're not even patterns, right? I'm hoping that the machines can find the patterns in the inconsistency. But not only are people's incomes increasingly volatile, their expenses are volatile. The whole, 80% of our expenses are fixed. That's a lie. It doesn't really work that way. And so when you see firms trying to really understand people's financial lives and to be able to make some of those automated decisions, it's a lot harder than it looks. And I think we're only in, you know, the second or third inning of that game.
You know, it's interesting, this idea of, you know, the volatility is only increasing, and that actually will make it harder to pick out the patterns, right? If it's not reproducible, how do you actually help structure those choices for the consumers and use the behavioral economics? And I wonder if the part we need to focus on isn't the financial end of the, you know, the whip that's going on, but we need to fix some of the behavioral, you know, at the outset, because part of what you got me thinking about is I've seen some very cool apps out there that help people change their neuroscience, specifically around addiction, by looking at triggers and why they make choices and what they're feeling when they make those choices. I wonder if, you know, part of the solution here isn't just dealing with the money. It actually has to start at a much deeper root to change people's psychology towards it.
That's really interesting. I have mixed feelings about that. I think that there absolutely are things called financial personalities. We each have different personalities. And on the one hand, I believe that people have the capacity for growth and change. And I also think that there are some things about us as humans that are hardwired. Having two children, right, raised in the same household, produced by the same two parents, but are totally different humans, right, sort of gives me this appreciation. And so it's not clear to me kind of where the line gets drawn. The other reason why I have mixed feelings about it is because I worry very much about this blame the victim thing. So we have to focus on people's behaviors and choices, but we risk going too far down that road and not thinking about the challenges we're putting in people's way.
Well, and I think that goes back to one of the underlying points where we have to look at those challenges we've created systemically.
Correct.
And, you know, and parts of that can be access, parts of that can be education, you know, and the other parts, frankly, are, you know, how we set up the way expenses and things, you know, from insurance and healthcare and others become real structural issues all along the way.
Right. And you know, it's a little bit like something as basic as jobs, right? What is work going to look like in this country? What does it look like today? And even if all the machines don't need our jobs, right? Like work is just changing. And in some ways it could be good for people. And in a lot of ways, it's not so great for people. And we've got to grapple with that. And I think that financial services companies and fintechs should have something to say about that. But beyond the broader policy implications, we've got to think about what does it mean when people are working multiple jobs and have multiple income streams and may not actually be formally employed by anybody. What does that mean for getting a mortgage, as an example?
Yep. Oh, dear. Don't make me relive that, having been self-employed over the last 15 years. It's reason number two not to ever, you know, move our house again.
Yes, or to be married someone who is gainfully employed. My husband is self-employed, so I understand the challenge.
Yes.
Well, I think part of what we're talking about here is stress. And, you know, survey after survey around these things talk about the degree of stress, the percentage of people, you know, over half of people are feeling stress. They're feeling it in the workplace. So it's impacting productivity at work as well. I mean, what are the kinds of things that you're working on to help not only improve the actual activity and the savings rate, but help to reduce the stress in consumers today?
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because stress is toxic. It's literally, for many people, significantly contributing to why they are physically ill. And there's a very significant link between physical health and financial health, and it's bi-directional. And so if you think about employers who are on the physical wellness bandwagon as a way to reduce their own healthcare costs, it's a little bit like bailing a leaky boat if they're not also addressing the financial stress and financial challenges of their employees, because often that's what's contributing to their being sick. So I really increasingly believe that financial health is everyone's responsibility, and that really everyone has a stake in it. The employers have a stake in it because it impacts productivity. Schools, universities, colleges have a stake in it because it's what's impeding graduation. I mean, think about it. 70% of community college students drop out, many of them after already taking on debt. That's horrifying, right? Hospitals and healthcare systems increasingly are being reimbursed by keeping people out of the hospital and out of the doctor's office. Well, how do you do that? You've got to be thinking about the broader array of issues that people are facing day to day. So at the end of the day, I think this is really all about changing the understanding about the role that we all play in promoting financial health, and that this is actually of national import.
Well, and you brought up two things I was going to ask you about is, you know, rising education expense and student loan debt and rising healthcare costs and, you know, under insurance. From all the work that you've done and the research that you've done and seen, is one or the other really a bigger driver? Which one would you tackle first?
You know, I don't think we have the luxury of picking.
Right.
Unfortunately, the interesting thing about the student debt is that it affects both this generation that's graduating and coming into the workforce, but it's also affecting their parents, in some cases their grandparents, who have co-signed. So you hear about these people who decades later are still carrying debt around, and it's not always their own, it's their kids' debt. And I do think the student debt is causing later, it's causing other kinds of developmental things to come later and later, which is not necessarily a positive. But on the other hand, like, healthcare is your life, and it's about longevity. And I think in both cases, they're not just important because they are, they're both about creating opportunity, but also how do you create that opportunity without being chained to debt. They also, there are big gaps between people of color and other non-dominant groups in outcomes in both of those arenas that we really have to tackle if we're going to make any progress.
I mean, you took this to a great place, Jennifer. Like, you've got my mind, you know, kind of spinning along several dimensions, and I think this went deeper than we expected. What's the one point, you know, if we were to end on here, what do we drive home with people? Is there one takeaway?
The
Save
one
money.
Right. No, I would presume that most of your listeners are actually in the financial services or fintech world. And to them, I want to say, this is what your customers want and need from you. They want help with these issues. You can't really say you're in the financial services business and then not actually be interested in the financial challenges of your customers. And so this is, I believe, the basis of competition in financial services and fintech in the future. And those who get there first are going to be most likely to succeed.
Boy, I love that. And then obviously the challenge is, you know, let's go back to what that business model is, because I understand the business model of putting you in debt and collecting interest and late fees. I'm not sure I understand how to execute the business model of a more responsible, higher saving customer, frankly.
I think everything in moderation. I'm not saying, I'm definitely not the burn your credit cards person. I think credit is so important. And we just talked about why. Education, ideally not healthcare, right? But investing in your future, starting a business. There are lots of good reasons to use credit. And there are some reasons why using credit, even for consumption, can be okay. But everything in moderation. And we just haven't quite learned that lesson in this country yet.
So, Jennifer, the financial pulse, you know, really is a great leading indicator here. What's your intent? You know, where do you see, now that we have a baseline established in 2018, how do you see these metrics being used to drive change?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. You asked me earlier, what's the one thing I think providers should do? And right now, I think it's measure, because what gets measured gets managed. And we like to think we know a lot about our customers, but the fact is, My experience is that we don't. We certainly don't know about their day-to-day financial lives as much as we think we do. And how can we possibly build strategies and businesses and customer experiences that are going to make money by helping people improve their financial health if we don't know where they stand? We're working with dozens of financial services and fintech companies. They're part of our Financial Health Leaders Program, in which they're using our methodology and 8 indicators of financial health internally, either with their customers or their own employees or both. And the Financial Health Pulse offers a national benchmark for how their customers or employees compare to national and regional data. This is going to be longitudinal data, which is really exciting. So we're not just going to be doing the same survey year over year, but to different people. The majority of people we will survey each year will be the same. There is no longitudinal data out there today. And then I think the last thing that's incredibly exciting about this work is we are just about to start gathering transactional data from some of the survey respondents. And that you can gather more frequently than once a year. It's going to give us an incredibly wholesome picture of people's financial lives, and it's going to ultimately enable us to start modeling what moves the needle. That's going to really help people leverage the pulse and our measurement tools to ultimately drive change and bottom line revenue at their institutions.
So welcome to Dean Brower, co-founder and executive vice president at GoHenry, a mobile application helping parents educate their children and spend their allowance in better and smarter ways. Something we talked quite a bit about with the need for things like this and tools to help us with Jennifer in the first half of the show. So welcome, Dean. Love for you to actually break down what problem did GoHenry set out to solve?
Yeah, thanks for having me, JP and Jason. So we set out to solve the problem of helping the next generation learn about money and build good money habits from a young age. And when you looked at the problem, the idea and the business actually started from a group of parents and friends. And there was a similar narrative happening in the families, which is probably very familiar to you guys, which was their kids were spending, using their credit cards to spend money on iTunes and download music, buy stuff on Amazon, whatever it was. And there was no oversight and control into their spending. And there was a real concern about as kids were moving into a cashless society, a digital economy, how would they actually learn the value of money and understand the value of money when it wasn't tangible and passing through their hands? So that was one problem that was observed in our own households. And when we looked at what the traditional banks were offering, what existed in the market, there seemed to be a big void. And as you look at consumer behavior, obviously, we're all aware of a cashless society and what's happening across the globe, you know, whether it's in China with mobile payments driving a cashless economy or e-com and just the purchase behaviors of people and the fact that everybody has plastic and everyone has a wallet on their phone and we can all transact. It was crucial that kids were able to take part in this economy and do that in a safe way. So when we observed the behavior in our own families, it was, how can kids start spending their own money? How can we do that in a safe way? And how can we empower and teach young people to learn good money habits through real world money management? And that's where the need is. Parents often also struggle with allowance. And I don't know if you guys have children yourself, but it might be familiar to you if you do, and you want to get the kids into an allowance regime. And often parents use a cash-based method, which is the predominant method in the US and the UK to give allowance. It's kind of fraught with friction, if you will. So you can't get into the right regime. Your kids are, you know, coming to you. Everybody you know, asking for money, you don't have the right amount of change, and it could become a negative source of tension in the family. We try through our tool to make that a positive experience, and you know, our customers tell us that we're doing a good job of that and helping parents by giving them a tool to help their kids learn about money. So allowance is...
Sorry to jump in, but I want to pick up two of the things you said in terms of you break the problem into two parts. So first, how do you solve the safety part of it?
Our view of it is we pair a spending card, so a debit card, we pair that with an app. So you can think of it of us, the app helping to make the card smart. And through the app, the parents can set controls on the spending so they can have some oversight and guidance and put up some guardrails, if you will. They could set weekly spending limits, single spending limits, and decide where the card can be used. In terms of where the card could be used in those settings, that's done at a category level. So parents could choose in-store, online, at ATMs. So in that case, what we're looking at is a use case like this. Let's say you have an 8-year-old with a card in the family and a 12-year-old. For the 8-year-old, you might limit cash and ATM withdrawals. You might limit the ability for the card to be used online. You might put very low spending limits in place and spending restrictions so that you're helping to kind of coach your child into forms of electronic payment. And they can't use the card online on anything they want, and they're spending in the store with you when you're out in the city on the weekend or whatever. And then for the child who's a bit older, the 12-year-old, they can have looser restrictions, and you might enable online spend and in-store spend and ATM withdrawals, higher spending limits. So it's tailored to each child to put, again, those guardrails in place. Then parents and children receive real-time notifications on their spend. So a parent will get a notification alerting them that their child has just spent. So it could say, you know, my child just spent $10 on Amazon. They have $30 left to spend, or they've just spent 10 bucks at, you know, Chipotle or whatever, and their available balance is X. And then the child, crucially, also gets that notification so that they understand their spend and what's left to spend. So we're making the connection for them between what's going out and what's coming in and what's left.
So, and then, Dean, how's that working so far? How do you measure success?
It's a good question. So for us, obviously, our mission as a company is to help millions of kids learn about money. For us, success is obviously, are we serving the customer very well? And our NPS score, our Net Promoter Score, our app reviews in iTunes and Google Play, and our reviews on things like Trustpilot, you know, those third-party websites, obviously give us an indication that the product is fulfilling the needs of the customer. We speak a lot to customers about how well it's working for them. We did some independent research and found that 86% of parents said their children are better at managing money since starting to use GoHenry. Our retention rates are very high, and the uptake of the service has been great. You know, we have community of 600,000 users in the UK and the US. So all that anecdotal and qualitative stuff gives us a lot of inspiration and sources of energy for feeling like we're helping to deliver on that mission. We're providing a tool for parents to help their kids learn about money, and we're giving freedom and independence for children to learn. Our data suggests that kids are saving. Anecdotally, we hear from parents all the time that when they switch from a cash-based method of allowance into using a tool like GoHenry, often their kids move from, you know, spenders into savers. And when we probe, it was this feeling that cash-based allowance actually burned a hole in the child's pocket, and they got the allowance and they just felt they needed to spend it. Versus GoHenry, where there's an initial excitement of them getting a card, but because they have an app, the child has an app, the parent has an app, and there's a feedback loop, so to speak, on your spending, children are starting to make choices about where their money's going, and they're seeing how much they're earning, how much they're saving, how much they're spending, And because the money becomes theirs and they're not using their parents' cards, ownership of it, over it, it's helping to change behavior. What we see is that a child is left with 42% of the money earned each month on their balance, which is, you know, a clear metric that there's saving happening. They're not spending all their money every month that's coming in. And the product to help explain that is we think of it as there's four money pillars. There's earning, saving, spending, giving. And the product, the app is connected to the card. And you have an earning opportunity as a child. So your parents can set tasks and chores for you to earn extra money. You have saving features, which help to build a habit of saving. So children, we automate the saving experience for children so they can input into the app the things they're saving for towards. So whether that's long-term and short-term goals, whether it's actual items they want to buy, like a new pair of Beats by Dre headphones, or they're saving, it's a cash-based goal and they're saving for their sibling's birthday. They just tell us what they're working towards, when they want it by, and how much it is. And we work out for them how much they need to save each week to reach their goal, and they can see themselves progress, and we automate it. So each week when their allowance comes in and they get paid for their tasks, a portion of that income, so to speak, goes into a savings bucket for them, and they could track and progress towards their goal.
All right. Well, we have run out of time for this week. Dean Brower from GoHenry, thank you so much for joining us. And Jason, I think that's it for another week.
Well, that will teach Brett to leave us unchaperoned. We go back to one of the things we're so passionate about, financial wellness. And so got to save the world. Thanks to our guests this week, Jennifer Tesher from CFSI, Dean Brower from GoHenry. If you have something to say about today's show or ideas for a future show, we always appreciate feedback, questions, and suggestions. Reach out on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm. If you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment, drop us a line. Our sponsors make this show possible. I know we say this every week, but if you like the show, one of the best ways you can support us is take 2 minutes to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps spread the word and grow our audience. You can check out our other podcasts from FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, and of course, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. That's all for this week, and look forward to chatting with you again next week. And in between, as Jennifer said, take a little bit of time. Think about your finances. Can you put away just even a few $100s to insulate yourself from that one emergency that could cause you financial hardship? That's all from Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.